Okay, Erev Tov, everybody. Hope everybody had a nice yontif, and so back into the swing of things. It's the first, you know, Thursday night in a long time. It's been a regular Thursday night. That's, yeah, looking forward to Pesach. I understand that. That's, anyway, but this we're kicking off. I believe we have 11 programs coming up in the next month. If you saw the email I sent out earlier today. It's very, I think, the most intense and, in a sense, exciting month in the history of Torah Motion, and it's a pleasure to have Dr. Lakshin kick off this series of events, and we brought him back, of course. He has been here many times to speak for us. Last year he spoke on his absolute field of expertise on Rashbam, and now he's speaking on someone perhaps a little bit less well-known, but he has also written and taught on the Bechor Shor. And I'll just wish him a belated mazel tov on the wedding of his daughter in Israel just before Yontif, a few weeks before Yontif. And say one other thing, I guess. Now we share a page or opposite page in the CJN now. Our columns are sideways. I don't know if anybody has noticed that. I'm on one side, on the left side. Since you, I'm on the business ethics, and you're on the right side. And, although I have to complain to Mordechai, because you get twice as much, you know, space as I do. But I really enjoyed your article yesterday on women and Kaddish, and it's really a pleasure to have you. And Bakasha.
Thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to be here at the Torah in Motion, and I've been given a difficult task of trying to introduce you to a rabbi who lived in northern France in the 12th century, about whom we know almost nothing. We know that Rav Yosef Bechor Shor's father's name was Yitzchak, Rav Yosef Bar Yitzchak. We know that he was from Orléans in France, and we know that he was a student of Rabbeinu Tam, Rashbam's younger brother, perhaps the greatest Talmudist of the Balei Tosafot. He's quoted a few times in the Tosafot. You look through the quotations, and the Tosafot can't really establish a worldview from a couple of short quotations in the Tosafot. We know that he wrote some poetry, and that he wrote a couple of piyutim, Bibchilat Kvodo, with apologies to him. I'm not sure that he was the greatest Jewish poet who ever lived. And we found, just in the last couple of centuries, we found his Torah commentary. It's likely that many, many rabbis wrote Torah commentaries, and that these Torah commentaries got lost. Rav Yosef Bechor Shor's Torah commentary is, like Rashbam's commentary, quoted by a few people who are contemporaneous or who lived just after his time. And then it seems that the commentary gets lost. It's possible that Rav Yosef Bechor Shor's commentary on the Torah was spread a little bit more than his older colleague or friend or teacher, Rashbam's Torah commentary, spread, because it's likely there's good reason to think that the Ramban had read Rav Yosef Bechor Shor's Torah commentary and appears to be reacting to it in various places. But then again, the commentary seems to fall, like many commentaries that were written, it fell off the face of the earth. One manuscript of it was found. Scholars argued for a while whether this is really the commentary of Rav Yosef Bechor Shor, and it's been established to the scholarly community that it is the commentary of Rabbeinu Tam's Talmud, Rav Yosef Bechor Shor. There were a few people who argued there might have just been two Rabbanim named Yosef, and they were both called Bechor Shor. We don't even know why Yosef Bechor Shor specifically was called Bechor Shor, but Bechor Shor, calling somebody the firstborn ox, it doesn't quite resonate the same way in English as it does in Hebrew. Just because of the blessing that is given to Yosef in the Torah, that was the name that was attached to him. What I thought I'd do tonight is try to convince you that it's a good thing that Rav Yosef Bechor Shor's commentary on the Torah was found. And that there's something new and different in this commentary on the Torah. And I'd like to try to isolate a few themes in this commentary. First of all, I'll just tell you like the standard scholarly consensus, which I basically agree with. Fast tour through the 11th and 12th century in Torah commentaries. Torah commentaries really didn't exist in Ashkenazic circles before the 11th and 12th centuries. The first and famous and most successful Torah commentary ever written in Ashkenazic circles is, of course, Rashi's Torah commentary that isn't really modeled on everything. Almost every Torah commentary that we have is modeled on the pattern of... Rashi came up with this pattern of a Torah commentary pretty well on his own. And we had, Rav Sadia Gaon writing in Judeo-Arabic, a few other attempts at Torah commentaries beforehand. And we know, we all are acquainted with Rashi's great programmatic statement, Ani lo bati ela lifshuto shel mikra. I'm simply interested in the pshat. I'm interested in the plain meaning of the text. And we know that very often we, the readers, are left scratching our head and saying, is this really pshat, what Rashi is doing? One day, maybe, we'll go back to the beginning and we'll have early Rishonim and I'll give a Rashi talk and I'll tell you how I try to solve the problem. But among Rashi critics, some of you may have heard my colleague Eric Lowy talk about this subject. Eric is particularly interested in a group of people whom he calls Rashi's resistant readers, people who couldn't stop reading Rashi's commentary on the Torah and didn't like it. My colleague, Professor Lowy, is writing a book that's going to have this, the provisional title of the book is Rashi's Resistant Readers. And perhaps the most famous resistant reader of Rashi around was Abraham Ibn Ezra, who wrote one time, Rabbeinu Shlomo Chashav Lefaresh Pshuto Shel Mikra. Rashi thought that he was explaining Pshuto Shel Mikra. Ve'im bo pshat ela achad mini elef. And it's true, one out of a thousand times he actually hits the pshat. The 999 times out of a thousand, he doesn't hit the pshat. So that's Ibn Ezra's unfair summary of Rashi. In the next generation, we have a couple of people who are totally dedicated to Pshuto Shel Mikra, such as Rashbam and Rav Yosef Kara, and an even less known Bible commentator named Rabbi Eliezer of Beaugency. And so that there was this middle of the 12th century, there was the period of what you might call radical commitment to pshat, of people who were willing to, Rashbam, I talked about last year and I can talk about again, Rav Yosef Kara has this amazing passage where he says, if you're reading a biblical passage and you see a difficulty in the text and you grab onto a midrash, let me tell you what that's like. It's like you're in a river and you're being swept away by this strong current in the river and you grab onto a blade of grass to try to stop yourself. It's just not going to help you deal with difficulties in the text. Strong words against the midrashic method and an insistence. The Rav Yosef Kara has the insistence. This is not Rav Yosef Karo, who is the great halachist four centuries later, but Rav Yosef Kara, the colleague of Rashi and of Rashbam, who says that the Torah was given with its interpretation in it, that one does not need anything else in order to interpret the Torah. Everything is in it if you just use your eyes and your brain and the text that is in front of you. So this was the generation of radical pshat. And the general scholarly consensus is that Rav Yosef Bechor Shor kind of was a little taken aback by the radicalness of the radical generation of pshat, And he came up with an interpretation, he came up with a commentary on the Torah that represents a kind of attempt to find a compromise between Rashi's midrash-filled commentary, and there's a lot of midrash in Rav Yosef Bechor Shor's commentary on the Torah, and the radical parshanut, the radical commentaries of the middle generation. Instead of just telling you about the commentary, I thought the best way to talk about a commentary is, of course, to study the commentary with you. And so I've gathered together a number of texts here that I think show you something about the derech, about the exegetical methodology of Rav Yosef Bechor Shor. So let's start with a text in the beginning of Parshat Emor. Text number one. Does everybody have a copy of the handouts? The verses say, "Vayomer Adonai Moshe Amor LaKohanim Bnei Aaron Va'Amarta Lehem LeNefesh Lo Yitama Be'Amav Ki Im LiSheiro Akarov Elav LiMo LaAviv LiVno LiVito LaAchiv LaAchoto BeTzula Krova Elav Asher Lo Ayata LeIsh La Yitama Lo Yitama Baal Be'Amav LeHechalo." Okay, we all know this rule very well. A Kohen, someone who is from the sons of Aaron, is not allowed to make himself impure, is not allowed to come into contact with the dead, unless the dead person happens to be one of his relatives. How many relatives are listed in that, in verses 2 and 3 there? Well, the simple reading of the verse is that there are 6 relatives listed in the verse there. Imo, Aviv, Bno, Bito, Achiv, and Achoto HaBetula HaKrovaylav, father, mother, brother, unmarried sister, son, and daughter. And a Kohen would go to that to their funeral. Verse 4 is an extremely problematic verse, Lo Yitama Ba'al Be'amav Lehechalo, but a simple way of understanding the text is that a husband should not go to his wife's funeral, that a husband who is a Kohen should not go to his wife's funeral. This is not halacha. Halacha is that a Kohen not only is allowed to go to his wife's funeral, he is required to go to his wife's funeral. And if the Kohen says, I do not want to go to my wife's funeral because I'm a Kohen, mitamin oto ba'al korcho, he's forced to go to his wife's funeral. But how do you see that in the verse here? So we have Rashi's commentary here, who says, Rashi says, text number 2 here, Kim l'she'ero, ein she'ero ela ishto. When it says in verse 2 above, he shall not go, except for, text did not come out well. It says, verosh instead of she'ero, the letters got switched around. That's my fault, not Torah and Moshe's fault. I sent it as a PDF, so I guess I made the mistake before I even passed it on to Rabbi Jay. My apologies. It's the second line of the text in the English. The letters should be the other way around. She'ero, except for she'ero, mother, father, son, daughter, brother, or virgin sister. Rashi says she'ero means his wife, which is actually a very problematic claim to say that she'ero means wife, because you have a verse like Ish Ish al kol she'er besaro lo tikrevu legalot erva. No one should uncover the nakedness of his she'er. So if she'er means wife, then you know, then we're all in very big trouble. But Rashi says here that she'ero means ishto, and then he gives us this extremely complicated way of reading verse 4. Rashi makes even this is the pshat. I'm going to tell you what the pshat, how to read this verse here, the pshat. Lo yitama baal bishe'ero, be'od shehu betoch amav שיש לה קוברין שאינה מת מצווה, ובאיזה שער אמרתי, באותה שהוא להיחלו, להתחלל הוא מכהונתו. A lot of turns there, and you see how many lines in English were necessary to try to render that into English. If you are a Kohen who is married to a woman whom you shouldn't have been married to, then you shouldn't go to her funeral. For example, if you are a Kohen and you're married to a divorced woman, you shouldn't go to her funeral unless you're the only person who's there, unless it's a mate mitzvah. Rashi sees all those words there, so that's Rashi simply takes the Talmudic conclusion. This is the Talmudic conclusion of what the text, and he says that's the pshat. It's a question that I think about a lot: is what do people mean when they use the word pshat? And I'm trying to write a book on the subject. I'm still in the earliest stages of writing my book, in the thinking and reading stages of writing this book. But I'll just tell you that in the meantime, I think that when Rashi says "pshuto shel mikra" here, all he means is I am going to give you a reading that's going to relate to all of the words in the verse, not just taking one word out and talking about it, but a continuous reading of the verse. I think Rashi I assume that Rashi understands how far this is from the simple meaning of the text. Other commentators over the years have tried to deal with the tension between these two interpretations. See, Ibn Ezra at the bottom of the page here, Kim li she'ro ha'karov elav, hayan yireh lanu ki perusho kamo ishi shel kol she'er b'saro shem klal, v'achar kach prat la'aviv l'imo, v'tam bal ba'amav shelo yitama ha'bal b'ishto. You know, when I read this verse, I thought that the verse was saying you shouldn't go to the you should only go, if you're a Kohen, you should only go to the funeral of your she'er, and she'er means relative. It's a general term. And then they explain what a relative is: father, mother, son, daughter, brother, unmarried sister. And then verse 4 says ba'al ba'amav shelo yitama ha'bal b'ishto. V'cha'asher ra'inu sheheitiku rabotenu ki yitama l'ishto, Batel haperush harishon. But when I saw that the rabbis interpreted the text in the diametrically opposite manner, my first interpretation is canceled. It's null. I'm sorry? He's referring to the Talmudic rabbis. That is the conclusion of the Talmudic discussion of these verses. And so my interpretation. So there is this theory about Ibn Ezra that he was a little bit sneaky. That, you know, when I'm writing an article and I used to think something and then I change my mind and I don't think that, I don't always write in my article, I used to think this and then now I think like this, unless there's some particular reason for doing it. So is he kind of hinting that he thinks that? So there's some people who think that he's very sincere about this. And, you know, in his introduction to his commentary on the Torah, he makes it very clear. This I learned from, I think, the greatest Ibn Ezra scholar alive today, who's Professor Uri Simon of Bar-Ilan University, who says that one of the frustrating things about Ibn Ezra is that Ibn Ezra feels that every verse can only have one interpretation. And if he doesn't believe in the idea of multiple levels of meaning of a text, which is something that almost everybody who believes in Pshat and Midrash believes in, Ibn Ezra makes it very clear in his introduction that if he finds two interpretations, the Pshat and the rabbis disagreeing with each other, I have to do something about that. And so here he says, this is like an example of what he describes in his introduction, of a verse where the Pshat and the Midrash come to mutually exclusive conclusions. And he says, you have to. So you see, Rashi just says, here's what the rabbi said, and that is Pshat. And he works hard at getting the verse to say that. But again, with apologies to Rashi, not impressively from the halachic perspective, from the interpretive perspective. Ibn Ezra gives up. And it says, Batel HaPerush HaRishon. Rashbam, the next one on the text, text number 4 says, Lo yitama ba'al ba'amav, shum ba'al ba'am ha'kohanim, lo yitama le'ishto. What do these words mean? It means that no Kohen should ever go to his wife's funeral. Shum ba'al, why does he emphasize shum ba'al? Because Rashi said, no, it's only referring to a Baal whose wife shouldn't have been married to this woman. So Rashbam says, no, what the words mean here is that no Kohen should go to his wife's funeral. That's what the Pshat says. Lahechalo shahare mitchalel mikuhunato. This would wreck his kahuna. This would make his kahuna not be holy anymore. And then he says, in his charming way of being able to say two contradictory things at the same time, ulefi divrei chachamim lo yitama lisho psula mchulelat al mitame leishtok shera. So I've told you what the pshat means, and here's what the rabbis say. The rabbis say that Kohen does go to his wife's funeral unless he shouldn't have been married to her in the first place. How does Rashbam resolve these conflicts, offering interpretations that are against halacha? He never explains. He does it, I counted once, and for the index for my book on Rashbam, I counted up the number of times where Rashbam offered an interpretation that was contradictory to halacha. In his commentary on the Torah, and it's just short of 30 in the commentary. Just short of 30 times in his commentary on the Torah, he explains a verse in the Torah in a way that contradicts halacha. Sometimes, like this time, he at least tells you what the halachic interpretation. Sometimes he doesn't even bother. And it should be remembered that Rashbam was a giant Talmid Chacham, and he wasn't interpreting against halacha because he didn't know what halacha was. Chas v'shalom. He thought that pshat could sometimes reach a conclusion that is the opposite of what the halacha tells us to do. Perhaps a very a precocious, postmodern kind of approach way back in the middle of the 12th century. But before we go on to Bechor Shor, let me just pose this question. Does it make any sense to say that a man would go to the funeral of his mother, his father, his wife, I'm sorry, his mother, his father, his sister, his brother, his son or his daughter, but wouldn't go to his wife's funeral? It does make sense. Why does it make sense? They're blood relatives. I agree with you. But before I agree with you, I just want to try to explain the other side, which is all of us think that our relationship... Right. All of us think today that our strongest relationship is with our spouse. I have two sisters. Some of you know my sister who passed away. I have another sister who's alive and well, with whom I am very friendly, and I really enjoy spending time with my sister. But it's not quite the same as spending time with my wife. And the relationship that I have with my wife is a lot stronger than the relationship that I have with my sister. Yes, please. Ah, very nice. Okay, that could be a svara to explain this. And I'll get back to that point very soon. But I think that Dr. Silverberg, yes, Dr. Sir. Right. But that's only for aviv v'imo. So the avelus difference is only for a father and mother. There's the same avelut for a spouse as there is for a son, a daughter, and that's presumably the standard explanation is the reason for the year is because there's also the mitzvah of kibud avim that's mixed into it, and not just because of the closeness of the relationship. But I think that the argument could be made that in the ancient world, the nature of the relationship between a husband and a wife might have been a little different than the nature of the relationship today, and that very often people saw marriage as kind of economic agreements between families. And in one of my favorite plays from Greek literature, The Antigone, the Antigone is the story of a young woman named Antigone, who had two brothers who were fighting about which one of them would be king, and they killed each other in battle, and then their uncle took over as king, and the uncle decided that one brother was good and should get a state funeral, and that the other brother should not get buried at all, and the body should be left out there to be eaten by the birds. And decreed that anybody who gave burial to the body of the bad brother would be killed. And the princess Antigone heard this, and she went and she buried her brother's body, even though she knew the law. And she makes it's a beautiful story about the conflict between conscience and the state. And the laws of the state, where she said, "I did not think your laws stronger than the unwritten laws of the gods," and raising a lot of great issues. Towards the end of the play, when Antigone knows that she's about to die, that the king really is going to kill her, kill his niece for breaking his law, she comes up with a line that. I used to teach this play at York. My students always had great trouble understanding this line, where she says, "I would never have done this for any husband, because if you lose a husband, you can always find another one. But a brother, when you lose a brother, where are you going to find another brother? Especially, my parents are now dead, so you lose a brother. That's a real loss." And I used to spend a long time trying to convince my students that people in the ancient world really did feel that way, that the nature of their relationship with their blood relatives, as Sammy said before, it was much stronger than the nature of the relationship. The question is, are those Torah values? To be able to prove that those are values of some systems in the ancient world, I think I can prove that. But, so that's where Bechor Shor comes in. I'll read his commentary, and then I'll tell you why I am really interested in what Bechor Shor is doing in this commentary here. A rabbi said, "She'ero" means his wife. So one can also see at the end of the section, maybe I'll read it in Hebrew, and those of you who want can follow along. Kim l'sheiro, amru rabotenu sheiro zo ishto. V'chin mochiach sefer de parsha, shekohen mitamel li ishto. Midichtiv, lo yitama baal ba'amav lehechalo, hashalo lehechalo mitamel. Okay, that's like Rashi. Uchtiv nami. So here's what Rav Yosef Bechor Shor, so he's defending Rashi's position in the beginning. But then he adds something. Uchtiv nami v'lachoto habtula asher lo haita le'ish. Ha im haita le'ish lo yitama la. Ki im ba'al kovra umitamela v'afilu hu kohen. Dichtiv v'hayu lebasar echad v'ein kurva gedola mizo. How do I know that the rabbinic interpretation of the text here is the correct interpretation of the text? Because we see, for those of you who are concerned, in halacha today, a kohen goes to the funeral of any sister of his, whether she's married or unmarried, but it's only midrabanan that he goes to his married sisters. But the Torah law seems to be that he only goes to the funeral of his single sister. And he doesn't go to the funeral of his married sister. Why? Because she now has a stronger relationship than the brother relationship, is his understanding of the text. This is close to what you're saying. Not precisely what you're saying. This is close to the way that you're looking at it. He says, within the text here, I see proof that the relationship, that the Torah understands the relationship that a husband and wife have with each other as being stronger than the relationship that a brother and sister have with each other. What do I found interesting about this? You could either agree or not agree with his reading of the text, but what I've collected a number of examples like this, where Bechor Shor is using his skills as a text reader to try to solve the tension, to show that the rabbinic understanding of the text can be supported by the words. Rashi's attempt to read the words leading to the conclusion of Chazal did not impress us as parshanut. It's true, it's halacha. They did not express. Ibn Ezra just says, "Here's what I thought the words meant." The rabbi said they don't mean that. Okay, I give up. I lift up my hands. Rashbam says, "Here's what I say. Here's what the rabbis say, and they disagree with each other. You want to make something out of it? You know, it doesn't say anything more about it." What Bechor Shor is, I think, the first commentator who, if you go through his commentary on the Torah, you will find that he's trying to solve this Pshat Midrash conundrum, that he's trying to read the text in such a way as you'll be able to find the conclusion of Chazal in this. This will become, later on, a very important theme in Parshanut, but I don't find anybody doing it before him. This is the first commentator who's trying to do that. Okay, so that's theme number one that I found that interests me in Yosef Bechor Shor's commentary on the Torah. Before I go on to other... Anybody want to ask anything about that theme before I go on to other topics? Okay. Bechor Shor, I'll just tell you my conclusion before we read the text. Bechor Shor is the first commentator that I know of who I am convinced knew a lot about Christianity and wrote about Christianity frequently, not in a friendly manner. Just as Rashi and Rashbam did not write about Christianity in a friendly manner before Rav Yosef Bechor Shor, but I see no evidence of Rashi or Rashbam really knowing what it was they were criticizing. I see no reference to Christian doctrines in Rashi or Rashbam, with one possible exception. It is possible that Rashi's comment on last week's Parsha on the verse V'ha'adam yada et chava ishto, where he says, Kodem ha'inyan shel mala, kodem shechata v'nitrad migan Eden, where he insists on saying that that Adam and Eve had sexual relations before they sinned and before they were kicked out of the Garden of Eden. It is possible that Rashi had heard the Christian doctrine that suggests that sexuality is a result of the fall of man and the sin of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, and the original ideas that there wouldn't be sexual. It's possible that that Rashi is trying to say that, although that only works when you look at the beginning of Rashi's comment, because Rashi also says v'chein ha'hei rayon v'chein ha'leida. You know, Rashi is actually just passing on a midrash from Masechet Sanhedrin about what happened in the Garden of Eden on that verse, where it claims that that there was like a one-day pregnancy or something. So that in the same day they had intercourse, And there was a one-day pregnancy, and the babies were born before they were kicked out of the Garden of Eden. Maybe Rashi is showing acquaintance there with some Christian doctrine. Bechor Shor shows a lot of acquaintance with Christian doctrine. First of all, here's his commentary on Numbers chapter 12. Is it possible that this is one of the reasons that the commentary wasn't passed on that much, that there weren't copies of it for a lot of years? It is possible. You want to say something? Please. I'd like to see that. I'm willing to be convinced, but I don't see evidence of that, and I don't see him being concerned about Christianity when he's writing his commentary. When he's writing about Yain, of course he's worried about it. Yes. He has to be concerned about it. Right. Well, I'd like to see any evidence about knowledge about Christian doctrine and discussing Christian doctrine. Okay, so here's Bechor Shor. Pe el pe adaber bo umare velo bechidot. There's a typo here, should be beit velo bechidot. Uvechan nishberu zroam shel omot haolam shomrim ama she'amar Moshe Rabbeinu allegoria him. Here is proof from the verse here in Sefer Bamidbar is proof against the Christians who claim that the Torah is to be understood allegorically, when the Torah says it's lo bechidot. It's not a riddle. It's not to be understood as a riddle. I'll get back to the rest of that comment. Let's just see a couple more examples of his knowledge of Christianity. Little digs at Christianity. Let's just raise this issue. Let's look at 15 on page 4. Text 15 on page 4. Navi mikirbacha me'achecha kamoni yakim lecha Hashem Elokecha. I will raise up a prophet for you from among your own people like myself. What does kamoni mean? It means kamoni miyuchas me'av va'im. It means a legitimate kid, somebody who actually has a mother and a father. All these little digs at Christianity in his commentary, number 16 on page 5. Vayikach et ha'egel asher asu, vayisrof ba'esh, vayitchan ad asher dak, vayizer al pnei ha'mayim, vayashke b'nei Yisrael, litshuvat ha'minim shemaligim al ota shtia, emor lahem bekan remez, Elohim she'ochlim v'shotim oto, ein bo mamash. V'heim ochlim b'sar tarfutam, v'heim shotim damo b'chol shana. The goyim that I know around here, they like to make fun of the Jews. The Gentiles, particularly the Christians, like to make fun of the fact that the Jews were not... you see the disloyalty of the Jews, that they built the golden calf immediately after leaving Egypt. That's because they are a faithless people. And so there are just all sorts of Christian commentaries about the Egel and making fun of the behavior of the Jews there. And Bechor Shor says, you know, they like to make fun of the Jews who have to drink this mixture of eagle dust and water. But whenever they tell you that, you should tell them, well, you know, the Torah teaches you here that if you drink anything that's eatable or drinkable isn't a god. And making fun of their Christian ceremony, the ceremony of the Eucharist, where they think that they are eating the blood of the blood and the flesh of their God. Text number 14, the end of the text, where Bechor Shor says, I'll also do the beginning of it, but just collecting a few examples of text here about Christianity. Im yomar lecha min bishvil shlosha chalakim hu omer lashon rabim ki zehu pshat ha-pasuk. Emor lo, if you ever bump into a Gentile and he says to you that the reason that it says na'aseh adam, let us make man in our image, is because God is in the plural, here's what you should answer. So he's aware of Christian interpretation. He's encountering Christian interpretation. He's dealing with it in his commentary in the Torah in a way that Rashi and Rashbam did not deal with this. So, from that perspective, there's just a few examples of little digs of his about Christianity in his commentary. But aside from that, he also let's go back to text 6, where it just started with his little dig at the Christians who think that texts in the Bible should be understood allegorically. But then he goes on, third line of text 6. Gam mi bnei amenu shamati shemefakpekim al tfilinu mezuzot v'kisui hadam. Shomrim, v'ya lecha lo'ot al yadcha ul'totafo ben enecha u'chtafta v'mezuzot v'etecha v'sharecha. Shehu kamo simeni kachotam al libecha, kachotam al zroecha, shetizkereni tamid. Veino chotam al zroo v'libo mamash. You know, I have this problem not just with Christians, but I have it with Jews too, who are offering metaphorical interpretations of biblical texts. And I know Jews who say that when it says, it shall be a sign on your arm and a decoration on your head, they think that that's a metaphor. They think that it's like that line in Shir HaShirim that says, place me as a locket on your heart. And everybody knows that when they say in Shir HaShirim, place me as a locket on your heart, it wasn't meant literally to play. It means, think about me all the time. And they say that those verses that we think are about tefillin are actually a metaphor. And looking around the room, it seems that quite a few people here recognize that interpretation was offered by his older contemporary, Rashbam. At least on the tefillin one. Rashbam didn't say it, at least not in the commentary as it came down to us, didn't say it about mezuzah, and didn't say it about kisui hadam. It seems, it's unclear who Bechor Shor is attacking in this text. But he's angry at somebody, at some Jewish people. V'chein elu einam mamash tefillin u'mezonot u'mezuzot, oy lahem me'elbona shel Torah ki afhem atidim litein et hadin. Woe to them for this insult of Torah. People who offer interpretations like this will yet pay for having offered interpretations of this. So there are two possibilities. There's possibility number one is that he's really upset about the excesses of extreme pshat that were offered by Rashbam and the other people in the generation before him. The other possibility is that he now, both of these are interesting possibilities. Possibility one, he's upset about what the commentators before him did. Possibility number two is that he's the first commentator in northern France who's heard of the Karaites. And it may very well be that he's encountered some Karaite interpretations. Rashi and Rashbam never touch the Karaites. Some people say that presumably, because they didn't know about the Karaites. Pardon me? Sadia Gaon's writings were mostly in Judeo-Arabic. They couldn't read Judeo-Arabic. What did they know about what Rav Sadia Gaon had to say? There were no Karaites in Ashkenaz in those days. Later on, we have Karaites in Eastern Europe, but they were an unknown phenomenon there. I think that one of the major differences between the different commentators in the 12th century is how much knowledge of what is going on in Sfarad is moving into Ashkenaz. And I think that Rashi had less knowledge about what was going on in Sfarad. Rashbam had a little more knowledge. He had read more grammar books than Rashi read, not because Rashi wasn't trying to read the grammar books, but they hadn't been translated into Hebrew yet. The great works of Yonah ibn Janach and Yehuda Chayuj, who really were the ones who created the Hebrew grammar that we have in our books today. All grammar books are really based not on Menachem ibn Sarek or on Donosh ibn Labrat, who were brilliant people who created an interesting system, but the real system that we have with the three-letter root, neither Menachem ibn Sarek nor Donosh ibn Labrat nor Rashi knew about this idea that we all teach our kids in grade one, that every word in the Hebrew alphabet has a three-letter root, and if you can't see the three letters, it's because some of them fell away. Which isn't it's not a fact, it's a theory. It's a theory that was first offered by Yehuda Chayuj and Menachem ibn Sarek. And Rashi's grammatical explanations, the reason that it's so hard to understand Rashi's grammatical explanations is because we've all been taught the three-letter root theory of the Hebrew language, and Rashi didn't know about it because he couldn't read it because it had been written in Judeo-Arabic and it hadn't been translated into Hebrew yet. And the reason why I think, I know that I'm chashud al adavar, but the reason that I think that Rashbam sometimes offers better grammatical explanations of words than Rashi offers is because he was able to read the works of Yehuda Chayuj and Yonah ibn Janach because they'd been translated into Hebrew. By the time Bechor Shor comes along, more knowledge of things going on in Sfarad have come up into Ashkenaz. Professor Avram Grossman was the first to write the people who think that there was like this border at the Pyrenees, you know, where knowledge stops, you know, that nothing got across the border into France, and nobody found out anything about what was going on in Spain. This is a mugzam. It's an exaggeration to say that, but it took a while for the various great ideas of Spain to make it there. And so it's possible the Bechor Shor is upset about Karaites. I go back and forth all the time about whether Bechor Shor is upset about Karaites or whether he's upset about the rabbis who he knew and loved there in northern France, like Rashbam. And I'll tell you why I think, I'll try to prove to you, this isn't final proof, but I'll try to tell you why I think that he's mostly talking about his friends there in northern France. And that's from the next text. Yes, Jay. Oh, right. Maybe he's not talking. Well, okay. Well, the next one you'll see, he's talking about rabbis, I think. I think you'll see in the next text, in text number 7, I think he's talking about rabbis. Some, you know, there's no unanimity among Karaites, but some Karaites wrote that when it says to cover the blood, what it means is that you don't drink the blood, you let the blood just fall down into the earth. That there's no specific mitzvah of covering up the blood with some earth. It just means that, you know, you slaughter it, you let the blood go down into the earth. Some of the Karaites said that. So here's Bechor Shor on Dvarim Vavuch, Tavtama, Muzuzo, Veitecha, Visharecha, text number 7. Hamafarshim shezek kamo simeni kachotam alibecha ve'eno medaber bitzvilin u'muzuzot to'im u'meshabshim umarim panim batorah shelo kahalacha. Anybody who interprets this as a metaphor or as an allegory, they're wrong, they're distorting and misleading, and they are interpreting the Torah against halacha. Uma ta'am lo natnu lev al rabotenu. Why didn't they pay attention to the Talmudic rabbis? What do we know about the Talmudic rabbis? Shayu yodim l'taher et asheretz min haTorah. They say about the Talmudic rabbis, about the smart ones, that they could prove anything. They could prove that a sheretz, that a reptile, is really kosher or is really pure and is not a source of impurity. That was the sign of a real Talmid Chacham, that he had the pilpul, that he had the knowledge, that given the task, prove to me, even the saying that it's possible to do 150, to offer 150 proofs why a sheretz is actually tahor. So the rabbis were able to do this. It's an interesting theory of interpretation here, that really, if you use interpretive methods, you can prove anything. Yes, please. We'll see what he does with it. He says they had the ability to do this, and they didn't do it. They Right. So the Gemara says, they said that's something great, and that to have that ability is something great. It's a sign of great wisdom. But people who had that ability didn't use it. Rav Meir did not walk around saying the sheretz is tahor. He just used to show off his bravado that he was capable of proving something like this. And so we all know that it's possible through using interpretation, rules of interpretation, you can come to just about any conclusion you want to. But you have to have some kind of system restraining you. And the Talmudic rabbis had a system that was restraining them. They knew how to prove from the Torah that a reptile is kosher, but you'll never find any one of them removing even one mitzvah from the Torah. They never used these systems to try to eliminate mitzvot from the Torah. Lo timtza achad meyem shechiser mitzvah min haTorah, v'lo nechlaku rak b'dikdukei al mitzvot. They only argued about details, but they never said, oh, let's get rid of this rule. Aval la'akor guf mitzvah lo timtza machloket. You'll never find one of them who says, okay, using my powers of exegesis, my powers of interpretation, I'm going to remove one of the mitzvot from the Torah. V'heim mechasrim bifshatehem. And they remove mitzvot from the Torah through a pshat, through their pshat interpretations, through saying, when it says, a sign on your hand and a decoration on your head, that it's a metaphor, and that gets rid of a mitzvah. Shara lehu maraihu. May God forgive them for doing this. So maybe this is just a coincidence, but that phrase, Shara lehu maraihu, Shara le usually. Pardon me? Right. Yes. When it's in the Gemara, Dr. Judah points out correctly, in the Gemara, when one of the Rabbonim in the Gemara says, Ein Mashiach l'Yisrael, then they say, pardon me? It was Rav Hillel, yes. Pardon me? Because Kfar Achaluhu b'mei Chizkiyahu, because in the days of Chizkiyahu, that there is no Mashiach coming. That forgive him for saying something like that. He shouldn't have said something. So first of all, I would like to argue that you usually use the phrase Shara lehu maraihu or Shara le maraihu about somebody who, in general, you like, somebody you'd like to give a hug to, but you think that they're wrong. Not, you wouldn't normally use it about a group like the Karaites that you would see as being really, really bad people. And second of all, by coincidence, Rav Yosef Bechor Shor's teacher also used that same phrase in the next text, and we'll see where Rabbeinu Tam used that phrase. Please. It's Rav Yosef who said it about... very good. Oh. I love it. Very good. But I'm also going to say that he learned it from his teacher, from Rav Yaakov Tam. See what Rav Yaakov Tam says about my friend Rashbam and his grandfather and their grandfather, Rabbeinu Shlomo. Gam Rabbeinu Shlomo im higia girsa beferushav higia. Rabbeinu Shlomo, Rashi, sometimes amended the text of the Talmud. But when he did, Aval b'sifro lo higia. He never actually wrote his emendation into the copy of the Gemara. He just, in his commentary, he wrote, Hachi Garsinan, which means, you know, I'd like to propose the following reading of the text that isn't in the Gemara that we have here in Troyes, but he didn't change the text there in Troyes. He had, in his commentary, he says what he thinks would be a better reading than the one that's in the text there. People who came after him, and it's the problem with the Vilna Shas, I think all the time, whenever it sees Hachi Garsinan and Rashi, it fixes the text of the Gemara to conform with what Rashi, or you think maybe even before that they were doing it. Pardon me? Yes, for sure, maybe even before that. Here, Rabbeinu Tam is saying that the followers of Rashi are going, and they're correcting their text of the Gemara. This is a few years after Rashi died. They're correcting their text of the Gemara on the basis of the of Rashi's suggestions, and Rashi always wanted them to be on the side and not in the text. V'share le mare le Rabbeinu Shmuel. But God should only forgive my brother Shmuel, says Rabbeinu Tam. Ki alachat shehigia Rabbeinu Shlomo higia hu esrim. That Rashbam, my brother, emended the text of the Talmud 20 times as often as our grandfather Rashi did. V'lo od ela shemachak hasvarim. And not only did he amend, but he amended in the text. When he thought that he had a better reading of the text, Rashbam, those of you who have heard me talking or other people talking about Rashbam was a man of great self-confidence. And when he thought he had the right reading of the Gemara and the text of the Gemara there in Troyes was wrong, so he corrected the text. He didn't write it on the side. V'yadati ki migodel libo v'omek pilpulo asazot. And I know that he did it because he's a very brilliant guy. And because of his brilliance, he thought that he was coming up with the right text of the Gemara. I think that there's just this really interesting comparison here between text 8 and text 7. We have very smart people using their wisdom to do something that's either a little heterodox or a lot heterodox. And we have a teacher, Rabbeinu Tam, and a student, Bechor Shor, both of them saying, Shari le mare, God should only forgive this person for this behavior. And I think that just the way it's clear in text number 8 that it's Rashbam, it's a good chance that in text number 7 it's Rashbam and those radical pshat interpreters who Bechor Shor is going after. Yeah. Yes. Right. Yes. 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 It's the same conclusion, but it's such a difference in tone between Atit Litein et Adin and between Shari Le Marayu. God should forgive him or God should punish him. There's a big difference between saying God should forgive him or God should punish him. So maybe it is possible that he knew both the Karaite interpretations and the excesses of what he saw as the excesses of the Pashtanim. Just as you should know, you know, consistency is not something that we find among, I would argue that we can't find consistency among any of the great Bible commentators, not in Rashi, not in Rashbam, not in Ibn Ezra, and also not in Bechor Shor. I just gave you an example here at the bottom of the page, of page 3 here. You have Rav Yosef Bechor Shor offering an anti-halachic interpretation of a biblical text that you won't find anywhere else and that is explaining the text against the halacha, but it's just when you like pshat, sometimes you are attracted to an interpretation of the text and it doesn't really fit into halacha, but there's this temptation to offer it anyways. And I guess he couldn't hold it in this time. He had this nice understanding of the text. Ki tigne eved ivri shesh shanim yavod uvashvit yetzei lachofshi chinam. You buy a Hebrew slave, he should work for 6 years, and the 7th year he goes free. Rashbam, following here, towing the line of halacha, says, Shvi'it lemechirato velo shvi'it lashmita. When the seventh year means the seventh year from the time he was sold, it doesn't mean that he goes free in Shmita. It means he goes free in the seventh year from his sale. And Bechor Shor says, Uvashvi'it she'eno choresh v'zorea v'kotzer uvotzer eno tzarich avoda kol kach. The Bechor Shor offers this anti-halachic interpretation that actually is saying that a Hebrew slave should go free in the Shemitah. Yes. I don't know. I guess it means for that period of Sheish Shanim before the Shemitah. Yes. Yeah, it has to be. It's not the most impressive interpretation. There's Rav Menachem Kasher wrote an extremely long and interesting essay about Pshuto Shel Mikra that I've reread a few times because I'm working on this topic these days. And he dedicates a few pages to try to understand what would bring somebody like Rav Yosef Bechor Shor to offer an interpretation like this against the standard halachic understanding. But that's just the exception, so to speak, that proves the rule. He can work. Oh, very good. He could work for up to 6 years, but because in the Shemitah he's going to go free. Okay, thank you for sticking up for our rabbi of the evening. The other thing that's in the last point that I'd like to make of what's interesting in the commentary of Rav Yosef Bechor Shor is that he was concerned about the problem, about philosophical problems, in the way that no other commentator beforehand in northern France was concerned about philosophical problems. He was concerned about the problem of anthropomorphism, of portrayals of God in physical language in the way that no other Parshan in northern France was. And why? Again, it's the slow way in which the thoughts of the Jews of Spain are slowly coming there into France. And by the time Bechor Shor comes along at the end of this heyday of Parshanut, the heyday of biblical commentaries in the 12th century, he knows what is being taught in Spain, and he goes along with what is being taught in Spain, the anti-anthropomorphic approach. Rashi, I don't want to be overly controversial here and say that Rashi had an anthropomorphic conception of God, at least, meaning, pardon me? Right. Yes. Right. So, I'll put it in the minimal formulation. Rashi wasn't concerned about the problem of anthropomorphism when he wrote his commentary. He wasn't trying to avoid anthropomorphisms in his commentary. See an example here, text number 11. This is God speaking, V'shalachti et yadi. He says, what does yad mean? Yad mamash. Lahakot bahem. Somebody who was concerned about the problems of anthropomorphism when talking about God would not use the phrase yad mamash in talking about God. Bechor Shor is the first of the great rabbis of Ashkenaz who writes things like text number 12, Vahasiroti et kapi veraita et achorai, I'll remove my hand, you will see my back. He says, know that all of this is only a metaphor. Heve yodea she'ein ze ki'im mashal. And he's concerned about these problems. Rashi isn't concerned about the problem of saying that human beings are created in the image of God. Rashi says last week's parsha, text number 13, "Betzelem Elohim bara oto perash lecha shoto tzelem hametukan lo tzelem diokan yotro hu." The image that was prepared for human beings is the image and likeness of his creator. You can either agree with Rabbi Slifkin or not agree with Rabbi Slifkin, whether Rashi was a corporealist, but you'll have to agree that Rashi is not concerned about these problems. He's not trying to avoid it. And Bechor Shor, when he begins talking about this, we read the end of text 14, but the beginning of text 14, Lo shezo domeh lezo. Don't say for a moment that human beings and God are similar to each other. Ki ein late dimyon udmut utmuna lamala. You can't talk about likeness. You can't talk about image. You can't talk about similarity when you're talking about God. This is Umasha Mara Katuv, Einei Hashem, Hador Maglav, Yad Hashem, Eino, Ella. There are two ways of reading this. Some people claim this should be read L'Saber Et HaOzen, and some people say that it should be read L'Shaber Et HaOzen. There have been articles, great linguists arguing about which one is the correct reading. But either way, it means it's just a metaphor to help people understand the text. But of course, God does not have an arm, and Bechor Shor is concerned about these things. Do I have time for one more example, or should I stop? Okay, just a last, pardon me? A quick example, yes. A last example of Bechor Shor's concern with philosophical kinds of thinking. Bechor Shor lived at the end of the 12th century. He was a contemporary then of Rambam, who lived from 1135 to 1204. Or perhaps from 1138, there's machloket on the historians about when Rambam was born. I found it really curious. I have a couple of examples like this, but here's maybe the most telling example, where Rambam and Bechor Shor came up with the same interpretation of a biblical text, which might not necessarily be the first interpretation that you would come up with of that text. I find it really hard to believe that Rambam, sitting in Egypt, writing the Guide of the Perplexed, around the same time that Bechor Shor was sitting in northern France writing his commentary on the Torah, that either one of them had access to each other's works, although it's theoretically possible. I think it's more likely that there's just a philosophical, rational way of thinking that Rambam uses when he looks at a biblical text, and Bechor Shor is using that same method when he's looking at a biblical text. And the example here is the Egla Arufa, that when a body is found that's been murdered and you don't know who killed the person, there's this whole ceremony that you do. And I would say in the pshat, that's a difficult word to use, in the pshat of the text, the text is suggesting that this Egla Arufa ceremony is in order to effect some kind of atonement or kapara. You know, blood is being spilled. V'nikaper lahem hadam. But both Bechor Shor and Rambam offer the same, more rationalist interpretation of the text. I'll just read them in English. Bechor Shor, this entire ceremony of the heifer whose neck was broken was done to make noise. Avsha milta, using a good Talmudic phrase. Sometimes the murderer is found that way. It's a way of getting people talking about the murder in town. That's why they had this whole ceremony. And that's what Rambam wrote in Moreh Nevuchim. The ceremony of the heifer whose neck was broken is of obvious benefit with the investigation and the elders leaving the city and taking the heifer. It is generally impossible that people will stay quiet about this murder. And perhaps through all the discussion, the murderer will become known. Ramban has this really strong comment against Rambam's explanation here. Ramban says, according to this explanation, that, you know, this is it's a utilitarian ceremony. It's just in order to accomplish a game, but there's no value to the ceremony itself. And how could he say that there's no value to the ceremony himself? But an Ashkenazi, one of the Balei HaTosfot, is offering the same explanation. So what I find interesting, the reason that I spend a fair amount of time studying Bechor Shor's commentary on the Torah, is This Torah commentary is, it's what happens when an Ashkenazi Baal HaTosfot starts learning about the Torah of Spain and the rationalism of Spain and the grammar of Spain, and even his poetry is a little influenced by the Spanish methods. So the Bechor Shor, I don't think that his commentary is going to take off. It did have a major victory recently when the Bar Ilan is now publishing a new Mikraot Gedolot called Mikraot Gedolot HaKeter, and Bechor Shor's commentary is now in this version of the Mikraot Gedolot. So that pardon me. Also, the Mosada Rav Kook has a separate volume of the commentary, but didn't put it on the page in their Mikraot Gedolot. The Mikraot Gedolot published by Mosada Rav Kook does not have Bechor Shor, but Bar Ilan just promoted him into the ranks of the. So, if you do buy it, I do recommend that's the best Mikraot Gedolot to buy. It isn't all out. The entire Chumash is not out yet. But once it is out, that's the best Mikraot Gedolot to have the most accurate text. And you start reading Bechor Shor's commentary on the Torah, you'll be reading about somebody who is one of the first people bringing together, I think, some of the best of Ashkenaz and some of the best of Sfarad, and that's what I find interesting about him.